Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kallik, and this is Dispatches. Over 100 years ago, a militia belonging to the King of Belgium massacred the family of a Congolese man named Ota Benga. Ota Benga himself was captured and sold to an American businessman who exhibited him in New York's Museum of Natural History in the Bronx Zoo. And Ota Benga eventually killed himself. The New York Zoological Society, which had lobbied to put him in the Bronx Zoo, was eventually renamed the Wildlife Conservation Society. And today, that society has been implicated by investigative journalist Robert Flummerfelt in supporting organized violence against Congolese villagers, intended to expel them using mortars, RPGs, indiscriminate fire, murder, and rape. The Congo has been plundered by the West for its resources, its people massacred and maimed, its heroes assassinated, in wars that continue until this day. But what Flummerfelt exposed at great risk to his own life was a new twist, whereby the indigenous people are punished again by Western forces, this time using the pretext of protecting wildlife. Unspoken is the racist element in this, prioritizing white tourists over native people. I'm happy that Robert's escaped death for now and can talk about his recent work in the Congo in general. Robert, welcome.
Thanks, Rania. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I mean, this what you uncovered is incredible. What you've been through to uncover it is incredible. So maybe here's a good segue into it. Why are people trying to kill you? Let's start there.
Yeah, that's quite the introductory question. So just to get into sort of the longer history of the investigation that we did, I mean, you alluded to a lot of it already, but I worked with a team of investigators for a period of about a year and a half, looking at Kahuzi-Biega National Park. Kahuzi-Biega National Park is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's an international tourist destination. It's overwhelmingly funded by international governments like the German government, for a while the U.S. government. And there are tons of programs from different conservationist organizations like Wildlife Conservation Society. And what we documented in our year and a half long investigation was, as you described, an organized campaign of violence designed to expel the indigenous Batwa people from their ancestral lands, which sit inside this park. And that campaign of violence entailed villages being burnt to the ground entirely, indiscriminate fire on civilians, Batwa civilians being killed execution style while their family members were forced to watch, Batwa women being subjected to group rape. We even documented instances of Batwa children being intentionally burnt alive by park guards in a heinous 3-year campaign carried out by park guards with substantial material and financial and military style support from the German government, from the US government in periods, and from organizations like Wildlife Conservation Society. And importantly, and this is really crucial, all of these international actors were notified in writing repeatedly of the fact that this is happening. They received letters saying that there's going to be a campaign designed to expel the Batwa from their ancestral lands. They received private letters specifically describing the violence as it was unfolding, and international actors didn't change their support. In the case of Wildlife Conservation Society, actually intensified its support at certain periods. Put simply, we documented this sort of really substantial Western-backed campaign of violence against indigenous people. You know, and in the process, when you were doing it, you know, we're not relying on eyewitness sources only. We're not relying on, you know, only testimonies from community members. We arrived in these villages days after their destruction, you know, literally while the villages are still smoldering, literally while blood-stained greenery is still drying in the sun, literally while there are still piles of shell casings from the weapons used by the attackers, you know, piles of shell casings from rounds used in AK-47s or even belt-fed machine guns, as well as containers from the mortars that were used and RPGs used on the villages. We visited the freshly dug graves. We were there in one case while a member of the community was buried. So put differently, it's an overwhelming body of evidence that we document in our report, which is published in April of this year, pretty strongly demonstrating that in point in fact, there was this organized campaign of violence targeting this community. When we published our report, which is in April of this year, got a pretty substantial amount of international media attention. In particular, the German government responded with a very strongly worded statement saying, you know, we're shocked and outraged by what's documented in this report. Now, of course, all that shock and outrage was not there. And we'll talk a bit more about this, a bit later. But all that shock and outrage was not there when the German government was being privately notified of the fact that this campaign of violence was ongoing. It's only when they realized there was going to be a bit of a public scandal that all of a sudden they're so concerned about indigenous people and the impacts of these policies. But nonetheless, German government said, we're so shocked and outraged and concerned. And if this proves to be true, there are going to be consequences, even for German government support for this park. And in connection with that, the German government funded and organized an investigation of the investigation. They called it a mixed and independent commission. It was funded by the German government. The German government hired an internationally renowned expert to write the report that'd be the product of it. It was coordinated by the institution and the Congolese government that ran the park. I was asked to participate, presumably to sort of lend a measure of credibility to the process. Otherwise it's sort of implicated parties investigating themselves, people working for Wildlife Conservation Society, working for the German government, or working for the institution in the Congolese government that carried out the violence. And so myself and my colleague, a Congolese researcher, who participated, who worked with us for the entire year and a half, met with the people coordinating this commission, provided really specific information about my colleague's identity. My colleague, his identity has been kept anonymous throughout the entire time period where we did this investigation. His name's not on the investigation. The concern was the fact that he's, from the area. He's a Congolese human rights investigator. But in the context of this German government-funded investigation, he sat at the table, gave really specific information about his identity. And then I went and accompanied the German government-funded investigation in the field. Within 3 days of that initial meeting, we started getting text messages from individuals, I can't say who they are, but individuals close to senior people in this institution, in the Congolese government, describing meetings by high-level people working for the park, within which the decision was taken to hunt down, kidnap, and kill myself and my colleague, in connection with the work that we did on this investigation. Crucially, in these messages, the exact highly specific information that was provided to this German government, the people working for this German government-funded investigation about my colleague's identity was cited. So put differently, we provide this information to these people. 3 days later, that exact information, really specific, is cited in connection with efforts to hunt down and kill my colleague and myself. So we were both forced to flee the country, him with his family. He's now in a safe house. And days later, we discovered that leaders of this community, the Batwa community, who were key sources for this German government-funded investigation, were also tipped off to efforts to hunt them down and kill them in connection with the fact that they spoke to this German government-funded funded investigation. So they were also driven into hiding. So put simply, what we have is a picture within which this German government-funded investigation into German taxpayer-funded atrocities in Eastern DRC culminated in efforts to hunt down and kill a Congolese human rights investigator, an international journalist, and indigenous leaders. Put differently, it was run like a blunt and violent mafioso cover-up, and that sort of brings us up to the present.
Wow. And I mean, just to be clear here, this story that you've uncovered and then were put to the task of helping the Germans investigate themselves, this is basically Western governments supporting the extermination of indigenous people, and it's all in the name of conservation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot here, and there's, you know, there's a sort of broader global picture. But looking at the sort of longer history vis-a-vis this particular community, the Batwa in Cauzi Biega, the Batwa lived in this area inside the park since time immemorial. You know, it is their ancestral homeland. And then in the middle of the 1970s, an international conservationist, this guy called Adrian de Schryver, who was the last, he was related to the last minister of the colonies for Belgium, world-renowned white conservationist, came in, met members of the community, asked them to show him the places where there are gorillas or other flora and fauna. You know, they sort of showed him around, received him sort of like a friend. He went back to Europe. And then he came back several months later, accompanied by park guards and soldiers, and announced to the Batwa community, this land no longer belongs to you. Now it's a national park, you know, and off you go. And their villages were burnt down and they were forced out at gunpoint. This was in the middle of the 1970s. And then he became the first chief warden of Cauzi Biega National Park. After this point, the Batwa community faced decades of landlessness and grinding impoverishment, but also the slow and steady death of, you know, of their culture, of key cultural practices and so forth. And here's what's really crucial, you know, for communities like the Batwa, their connection to this land, you know, their ancestral lands, represent a core part of, you know, their collective identity, and access to those lands represent, you know, sort of the key to an interrelated series of rights, you know, that are really at the core of their ability to exist as a sort of disparate community. So after the Batwa were expelled, based off of some estimates, you know, there's a very good study written by this guy, Albert Barume, which indicated that about 50% of the community died off from grinding impoverishment, from the trappings of, you know, different forms of discrimination, being locked out of political processes and so forth. This went on for several decades. Then in 2018, the community made the decision that they were going to return to their ancestral lands and rebuild. You know, put simply, they had faced decades of broken promises from all the sort of stakeholders involved with all of this. And were indeed sort of heading toward extinction in more senses than one, and made the decision that, you know, they're going to return and rebuild their villages. I think you could just like stop there at 2018 and look at the impacts on the Batwa community of their expulsion from their ancestral lands and make a case for, you know, this community being driven toward extinction, you know, toward extermination. But what came next, you know, as we talked about, is what's most remarkable. After they return, they're subjected to this remarkably violent campaign of forced expulsion, you know, literal violent destruction in many cases targeting civilians. So, you know, I make the argument in the report that we put out initially, you know, that the Cauzi Biega National Park is in the configuration in which it exists, incompatible with the existence of the Batwa of Cauzi Biega as such, you know. And if you look at, like, you know, people like Raphael Lemkin, the Polish jurist who, you know, coined the term genocide, you know, and you look at the different sort of examples that he uses when talking about genocide as a concept, you know, not like, not the definition in the genocide convention, but, you know, concepts that he uses, you know, I mean, that is sort of, it meets the definition, the slow destruction of a group as such, you know, the destruction of key elements of their culture, so forth. And this is steadily, consistently for decades backed by, among others, you know, the German government, who, you know, when confronted with this problem, would just sort of shrug their shoulders and say, well, you know, we're sorry the Batwa were expelled. We don't know what to do. We don't know what to say. So there's that. Additionally, here, let me take a sip of water. Sorry.
Please, please. The first of many.
Additionally. Yeah, first of many, hopefully. Additionally, you know, you mentioned Wildlife Conservation Society. You know, we document how Wildlife Conservation Society has really been up to their necks in this policy of violence against the Batwa. So as an example, Wildlife Conservation Society, at one point on a U.S. government-funded program, brought in Israeli private military contractors who worked for a firm called Maisha Consulting to provide military-style training with these park guards. Later on, Wildlife Conservation Society staff directly trained the park guards, you know, as they're locked in this sort of campaign, provided non-lethal military equipment to the park guards, and were paying the park guards throughout this period, despite being made aware of the fact that all this is happening. If you look at Wildlife Conservation Society globally, you know, it's really sort of a remarkable outfit that is a one-stop shop for everybody who wants to engage in sort of greenwashing. You know, and that's what's sort of interesting is, you know, they'll deploy these arguments about climate change and biodiversity loss. You know, I've got here on my phone, I had the unique displeasure of going to the Bronx Zoo at the end of last year, and they have these plaques up, you know, with all their corporate sponsors, or at least some of their corporate sponsors, just looking at this list, you know, people like, or organizations like Bank of America, Chevron, Citi, the Dow Chemical Company, JP Morgan Chase, you know, put differently, just, you know, go around the table, find all of the corporations up to their necks immolating the planet, you know, and they all, you know, are very comfortable to toss a, you know, couple million dollars in the direction of WCS because, you know, they have programs where there's a tree as a logo or something. You know, you've also got recently Obama was involved with a Netflix docuseries about Wildlife Conservation Society. Jeff Bezos has contributed millions of dollars under the auspices of the Bezos, you know, Earth Fund for WCS's program. So it's a really sort of enormous greenwashing front. But part of the way that they get away with all of this is the fact that they employ really aggressive rhetoric indicating that they're the best friends of indigenous people. When they received an advanced copy of our report at the beginning of this year, you know, so that, you know, they had the right to reply, first thing that they did was they rushed to this publication, Manga Bay, which is widely read by people who sort of watch, you know, conservation or, you know, climate change related issues. And they put out this op-ed about how we love, love, love indigenous people in Kauai-Zuniga National Park. And we hate, hate, hate the fact that they've had such a terrible time. And they used that op-ed to make the announcement that they had secured a co-management arrangement. So they had secured a sort of deal within which they would assume formal power within the park. More direct sort of formal power. Basically, it's in some senses their park. You know, it's run more or less out of the Bronx Zoo. And if you look carefully at their response to our report, they really don't challenge the factual merits of the fact that these operations against indigenous people happen. They just basically say, okay, you know, we train these park guards. We didn't know all this happened. We didn't find out until after the fact. And this is why it's so important that we need to assume power in the park. You know, so I find it to be a pretty peculiar argument to say, like, we provided military style training to park guards who turned around and wiped villages off the face of the earth. And that's the reason that we need more formal authority and we're excited to get it. You know, I find it to be a very peculiar argument, but they've deployed it with a lot of success. There are some other sort of interesting dynamics. You know, the guy who's now, you know, the park director, you know, within days after our report was published, the former park director was removed, and in came a new guy who's actually a Wildlife Conservation Society staffer. When in the middle of last year, we were documenting a heinous attack within which an entire village was destroyed, Batwa killed execution style, Batwa women subjected to gang rape, we wrote a private letter that was co-signed by Amnesty International, Minority Rights, tons of international organizations, sent to Wildlife Conservation Society, the German government, the American government, all the international supporters of the park. And I'll return to this letter in a bit. But from Wildlife Conservation Society, the only response to that letter that we got was this guy, a WCS staffer who now runs the park, accidentally hit reply all on his email to the then director of the park, the guy who's responsible for commissioning these attacks, where he said, bon courage in this dossier. Like, basically, good luck, you know, keep on going. Sorry, you got to deal with these pesky people who are documenting heinous abuses.
Oops.
You know, so... Yeah, right, exactly. Oh, fuck. So, you know, there's a good example of all of this, the reality of WCS's policies dramatically flying in the face of their polite rhetoric, which they shop out to everybody who's lining up to throw however many millions of dollars in their direction in the interest of greenwashing. Yeah.
You know, I think this is a good, like, because conservation is considered to be like such a progressive thing. Like, I think that's why a lot of rich people, they're like, let me make a tax deductible donation to some conservation society, make myself feel better. Also, you know, I don't have to pay taxes on that money that I donated. But, you know, I think it speaks to something that I'd like you to discuss, which is the core myth of settler colonial projects about this kind of virgin or unpeopled wilderness that Westerners have discovered. So I'm curious, can you speak about maybe the role of actual racists and eugenicists and settler colonialism among the founding fathers of the conservation movement, people like Teddy Roosevelt and Madison Grant?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, that is sort of, you know, when I sort of talk and think about conservation, I think it's sort of a distraction to think about it as something with its own, like, sui generis, you know, self-generated history, you know, that's sort of separate from everything else, neat and cordoned off. At the end of the day, I think about conservation, this sort of conservationism, as just another chapter in the sort of long planetary histories of, you know, settler colonialism, you know, rigid global racial hierarchy. And, you know, you touched on sort of a key concept there, which is, you know, look at different settler colonialist projects all over the world, you know, whether it's South Africa, whether it's, you know, in the US, you know, whether it's in Israel, all of these places where you have settler colonialist projects, one of the core foundational myths is this sort of idea that, well, this was all virgin landscape. You know, this was all virgin wilderness before we, the settlers, came in and did something with it. And indeed, the sort of unpeopled wilderness myth is really at the core of this sort of conservationism. You know, and one thing I like to say is, you know, the problem with unpeopled wilderness is first you need to unpeople the wilderness. And that's always a violent and destructive process. So if you look at sort of the long history of this sort of conservationism, it is indeed, you know, the sort of founding fathers of it are, you know, invariably a lot of scientific racists, eugenicists, in some case Nazis, and settler colonialists. So a lot of it, you know, it's actually, the national park has been called America's best idea. And, you know, a lot of people like to point to that, which I think is interesting. But this sort of model of conservation has been described as the Yellowstone or the Yosemite model. And if you look at, you know, Yellowstone and Yosemite, here are places where, you know, the state of California declared an actual, you know, it was called a war of extermination, you know, against native people, you know, so violent destruction of indigenous people. After those processes of violent destruction, you've got these self-styled naturalists like John Muir coming in and, you know, creating a sort of mythopoetics of wilderness, saying like, look at this really beautiful virgin wilderness landscape. How great would it be if we turned it into a tourist attraction for white people, you know? And when people like Muir saw, you know, because it never, even after the War of Extermination, these places were not uninhabited. You know, there were inhabitants. Muir, you know, described, you know, the homes of Native people as the unsophisticated wigwams of savages, you know, had, you know, remarkably sort of racist things to say. And John Muir is actually treated as like an Indianist and moderate in these sorts of spaces, looking at the more sort of radical people. You know, you mentioned Madison Grant. Madison Grant and Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was inspired by John Muir and Yellowstone and Yosemite and became a champion for, you know, the creation of these sorts of national parks. Madison Grant worked with Teddy Roosevelt to help create the New York Zoological Society. Madison Grant wrote a book called The Passing of the Great Race, which is about the Nordic races dying off to the inferior races and so forth. Teddy Roosevelt wrote glowing praise for this book, but Teddy Roosevelt wasn't alone. Adolf Hitler also wrote glowing praise for this book. He called it his Bible, in point of fact. And as you touched on, Teddy Roosevelt and Madison Grant worked together to not just create the New York Zoological Society, but facilitate Otabenga being displayed in a cage in a monkey house in the Bronx Zoo, which was the headquarters, you know, as I mentioned. And the Wildlife Conservation Society, a little bit late to the punch, They apologized for this in 2020, in June of 2020. So, you know, like a little over a century later.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, it took a little while. In the midst of the protests in connection with the movement for Black Lives and the murder of George Floyd, you know, their apology, which is framed as a public reckoning with a racist past, is even like a little bit defensive. It's like, you know, sorry that we, like everyone else back then, were really racist. like, not exactly the tone I would use if I were writing it. Thank God that I was not writing it. But in any case, you know, one thing that I like to say is, even while Wildlife Conservation Society is publicly apologizing for, you know, putting an indigenous forest-dwelling person from the Congo in a cage in the monkey house, they were actively supporting a contingent of paramilitary park guards that were raining bombs down on indigenous heads in eastern DRC. You know, how little changes in a century. And what is it that that can tell us, you know, about this whole milieu? There's another sort of interesting figure, this guy who created the Frankfurt Zoological Society. He was a member of the SA, the predecessor to the SS, you know, real like brown shirt Nazi. And after the Nazis lost the war, he ran to the Serengeti and, you know, sort of helped to organize sort of conservationist policies, very consistent with the Nazi, like Lebensraum, you know, sort of way of thinking about things. And that is indeed, you know, as you alluded, really strictly consistent with the way in which all these people sort of thought about these issues, you know, put differently, you know, the sort of superior white race is best positioned to, you know, sort of protect and, protect wildlife, protect these sort of wild spaces, whatever. You know, other populations need to be violently expelled. So I think that's, some of the sort of important elements around that.
No, it's utterly shocking that this isn't more discussed, because of how we celebrate, especially like the national parks, like these are celebrated, and we actually, people are like, oh, it's like one of the nice things that the government does is they keep these parks like well manicured and, you know, free for us to go visit, as like families go and do their vacations. They're having no idea about this horrible history. That's actually not really history, because it's still ongoing. Right. But this phenomenon that you reported on isn't actually, obviously, like you kind of just alluded to, it's not restricted to this one place in the Congo, not even just the Congo. So can you maybe describe Western support for conservation or even anti-poaching militias and some of its consequences? Because we all also often think of those as good things, because poaching is bad, right? Because also there's jerks who go and poach. So we do think of these as good things.
Right. And I mean, the poaching stuff in particular is interesting. This is maybe a bit of a tangent, but, you know, a lot of the times, some of the rhetoric that's employed about, you know, sort of military style support for these parks is the rhetoric of concerns about wildlife crime. You know, like if you look at the grants, USAID funded grants for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, under the auspices of which not just Cauzi Biega, but parks throughout continent of Africa have received substantial military style support. It's talk about, you know, wildlife crime, wildlife criminals. They bring in these advisors in a lot of cases. And it's interesting, we're talking about the sort of like, you know, Black Lives Matter moment, you know, the George Floyd protests, Wildlife Conservation Society sort of public posturing in connection with that. And WCS is not alone in sort of posturing itself as like a progressive organization in connection with that. But in effect, you know, if you look at a lot of these guys who are flown out, you know, to sort of conduct training, a lot of them are former police. It's interesting. You look at their, like, you know, you look at their Facebook timelines, they're posting like Blue Lives Matter, you know, like thin blue line sort of stuff, which is just sort of interesting.
And they're being sent to African countries to do.
Yeah, right.
Oh my God.
Under the auspices of programs talking about wildlife crime and wildlife criminals, basically internationalize a sort of militarized model for policing. You know, at the end of the day, these outfits, the park guards generally have sort of a police mandate. You know, and they're given military grade weapons, military style training, and it's really directly in parallel with a lot of the militarization of policing in places like the US and other places, which of course all that's absent from Wildlife Conservation Society falling over itself to, you know, put itself on the right side of history in connection with the movement for Black Lives. So that's sort of, and you know what, the other thing that's interesting in connection with that, you know, talking about sort of who's violating laws and who isn't, it's a sort of complicated issue. But another thing that we document in the report is the fact that the international governments have provided military style support to these park guards, including the US government, German government, violated the arms embargo in Eastern DRC. And the arms embargo is imposed by UN Security Council resolution, Security Council resolution 1807. You know, I mean, when Saddam Hussein violates Security Council resolutions, you know, that's a pretext for, lights out Baghdad. When the U.S. government or the German government violates Security Council resolutions or violate an arms embargo imposed by Security Council resolutions, you know, it's, you know, everybody sort of shrugs, you know, what is there to do? But what's sort of interesting is if you want to talk about poachers and things like that, you know, we need to sort of train these militarized park guards, you know, to go after those wildlife criminals. Well, you know, is somebody training militarized park guards to go after the people violating, you know, violating the arms embargo? No, you know, there's the sort of rhetoric of criminality is employed in a sort of deceptive way to, in effect, criminalize just entire marginalized and impoverished communities. And of course, that's the way it works in pretty much every setting. No, like it's only ever marginalized and impoverished communities that are meaningfully, you know, held to account in any way, you know, especially in a sort of violent and brutal way for crimes. So there's all that around the poaching. But there's a lot of other issues around this. So there's another park in Congo that is probably, well, it is a lot better known than Kahuzi Biega. It's called Virunga National Park. It's the subject of a Netflix documentary, you know, that's people have seen all over the world. I think it was nominated for an Oscar. Mm-hmm. The guy who runs it is a Belgian prince, this guy called Emmanuel Demarose.
Seriously?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and you know, he walks around in like olive fatigues, you know, like he's Fidel Castro. He literally walks around in fatigues, you know, really a couple stops short of sort of, you know, like pit helmet wearing goons that you imagine imagine sort of inhabiting Kenya in the 1950s or something. And it's more than just conceptual, and it's more than just theatrical and at the level of appearances. Demarode runs this park. Demarode, when he came in, was single-handedly behind the militarization of conservation in this park, really represents a sort of one-man force for, you know, and when I say that, what I mean is he brought in, again, ex-military from Belgium and France to provide military-style training with these park guards, really sort of brought in these hardball approaches, stuff that's been written about exhaustively by, you know, a lot of really brilliant academics, people like Judith Verwagen and others. And Demarode is married into the extended Leakey family. And the Leakeys, for those who don't know, are a British colonialist family. Papa Leakey, you know, the sort of grandfather in the conservation mafia, was involved substantially in putting down the Mau Mau anti-colonialist uprising in Kenya. He's, you know, one of the sort of founding fathers of anthropology. And Demarode's father-in-law is another Leakey who was single-handedly responsible for bringing militarized hardball approaches to conservation to Kenya when he was the first director of the Kenya Wildlife Service around 1990 under Daniel Arap Moi. So, you know, here's a good example of sort of incestuous colonialism, you know, very small.
Runs in the family.
Very small sort of family being single-handedly responsible for the militarization of conservation in two enormous countries on the continent. And when we look at the militarization of conservation in Kenya, as an example, it was interesting when early this year, before our report was published, a crew from DW, you know, the German news outlet, came to to do sort of a broadcast package about the report. And one of the people on the crew was a Kenyan guy. And as he was sitting for the interviews with Batwa, he said to me, you know, Robert, the entire time I was just thinking about the Ogiek. And the Ogiek is an indigenous community in Kenya who, again, are being denied access to their ancestral lands in connection with a forest reserve run by the Kenya Wildlife Service, literally being pushed to the brink of extinction and extermination. You know, there's just another example, and it's sort of one family of white dudes up top, and then one, you know, sort of extended network of indigenous people being pushed to the brink of extermination, you know, sort of on the ground. And then additionally, I mentioned the Nazi who, you know, went to the Serengeti and, you know, treated as a lion figure in conservation circles. He's one of the founders of the Frankfurt Zoological Society. Well, the Frankfurt Zoological Society is involved with running, you know, around the Serengeti, you know, another protected area, where just this week, you had Maasai people, you know, again, indigenous to the area, being shot by security forces. All of this was caught on camera in connection with efforts to push them off of their land. So, you know, I mean, and I could go on and on. I mean, you know, really, like the PNKB, you know, Kahuzi Biega is a very small case study in an enormous global problem. And there's just, you know, sort of one last thing here in connection with the sort of greenwashing and all these celebrities falling over themselves to support all of this. One of the people who's really up to his neck in supporting these sorts of conservationist projects is Leonardo DiCaprio.
I was going to say it's either Matt Damon or Leonardo DiCaprio. He's going to say one of those.
Leonardo DiCaprio. He was involved with that film that I mentioned, Virunga. He might as well say that he's willing to, you know, personally shed blood every time a park ranger is killed anywhere, especially in Virunga. But there was sort of an interesting moment, I think it was at the beginning of this year, where, you know, in connection with the dispute in Canada, you know, over land belonging to the Wet'suwet'en people, you know, in this pipeline, Leonardo DiCaprio publicly made very sort of in keeping with sort of Extinction Rebellion's position on the issue, made a very, you know, thunderous and enthusiastic stand on the side of indigenous people. Of course, you know, indigenous people in DRC or, you know, other people on the receiving ends of remarkable violence, you know, by these projects which are set up on literally set up on stolen land. You know, DiCaprio's favorite park, Virunga, you know, was set up by the Belgian colonizers. It's enormous. It's Africa's oldest park, and it's all just the land was stolen. People were forced out at gunpoint. The villages were burnt down. It's the same old story. You know, now if people try to go back in, you know, they're shot. They're arrested, they're transferred to military justice, so forth. You know, indigenous people on the receiving ends of those policies don't get the same sort of treatment from DiCaprio. Well, you know, what accounts for the sort of, like, you know, inconsistency? On Tuesday, I love indigenous people. On Thursday, I'm the greatest partisan of outfits, you know, that have stolen their land and are keeping them off their land at gunpoint. At the end of the day, it's just, you know, it's another excuse for celebrities to sort of masturbate all over us. You know, it's like,
right.
Nobody. I'm reminded of, there was, again, a little bit of a tangent, but in connection with violence from the Sandinista government in Nicaragua against, you know, the Miskito people. There was a speech given by a Miskito activist, you know, sort of making it clear, like, yes, we're anti-imperialist. Yes, we're opposed to U.S. efforts in Nicaragua. But also at the end of the day, you know, only Indians help Indians. You know, that was sort of the exact quote. And in a conversation with one of the leaders, you know, the Batwa, you know, I sort of made reference to that and talked about it. And it really, really resonated with that leader, because, yeah, the experience of the Batwa is everybody, Leonardo DiCaprio, Wildlife Conservation Society, you name it, everybody falls over themselves to talk about how they're the best friends of indigenous people. But the reality, of course, is one of dramatic and organized violence and enforcing them being kept off of their land. So,
yeah, This isn't to throw shade at people who do this, but there is this, like, growing effort, especially I see it a lot in Canada. It's not a bad thing where people will acknowledge they're on stolen land. And sometimes sometimes it's a genuine thing, and other times it's like this symbolic gesture that actually means nothing. Like, that's great that you're acknowledging you're on stolen land, but like you are on stolen land. Are you doing anything about it? Kind of situation. But what? You talked a little bit. We don't have to go too much more in depth in this. You actually talked about the German government response, but I just wanted to note that after the report initially came out, you had German government officials like going to this park and doing a photo op. Is that right?
Yeah, it's sort of remarkable. I mean, but this is what I was sort of talking about with the German government flatly not behaving like they gave a damn when the information about these attacks was not made public. So I referenced earlier that letter where WCS responded and said, you know, bon courage, blah, 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 blah. In that, after receiving that letter, officials in the German government, you know, again, this is a private letter in the middle of last year, officials in the German government, including the German ambassador to Congo, key functionary of GIZ, the German Development Agency, organized a trip to the park headquarters, not to investigate, but to smile, as you say, for a photo opportunity with the leadership of the park. The German ambassador gave this sort of remarkable speech based off of what the park put on its website, in which he congratulated the park guards for their dedication and their difficult mission. This is 11 days after an attack in which Batwa women are subjected to gang rape. At least one Mutwa woman died after being subjected to gang rape. Multiple villages wiped off the face of the earth, burnt to the ground. Batwa killed execution style while their families are forced to watch. And the German ambassador has given the speech about, how great the park guards are. And, he promised as well to try to persuade reluctant German tourists to come and visit the park. Really sort of, if I were writing a novel, and I sort of wanted to talk about neo-colonialist Germans being enthusiastic in their support for the extermination of an indigenous people, I suspect my editor, the publisher, would read that and say, like, try a little harder. It's not believable. Well, it happened. That's the reality. It's shocking. Just one more thing. I think a sort of interesting anecdote about all of this. Actually, sort of two things. Sort of an interesting anecdote about this. In the middle of our investigation at one point, GIZ is one of the German agencies that historically was substantially involved in supporting the park. These days, GIZ works outside the park and it's other agencies that are involved in supporting activities inside the park. But nonetheless, I was at an ATM in Bukavu and up came, this sort of large, German cooperation 4x4, with the German flag and the Congolese flag, and out stepped an employee of GIZ, who, she was dressed in, it wasn't even like Congolese, sort of clothing. It was like West African pattern clothing, had sort of dreadlocks, blue eyes, and sort of bouncing around, while, our team is knee deep in documenting, the sort of heinous consequences of German policy. And it's like, Hannah Arendt wrote about the banality of evil. This is like the triviality of evil. It's not even paper pushers, like a lot of sort of like frivolous people sort of bouncing around the world and being the functionaries.
Was she taking selfies for her Instagram page? Like, kind of sounds like what
she eventually did. I'm sure she eventually did. It's maybe a little bit much to get into, so I'll skip that. Yeah, there's something else, but I'll skip it.
Well, maybe we'll come back to it, because now I'm like a little bit, I maybe want to hear, but I also was, I think this is, you were telling me earlier before we were even on the call or on this interview, you were kind of alluding to the whole like white NGO humanitarian aid sort of sector and how they operate and all the money coming in. So I guess I'll let you take that on. Basically, can you describe the aid sector and their relationship to other powerful forces in the Congo? Because you also said something interesting, because you had brought this up to me. You described it as white NGOs behaving like settler occupiers. So I'd love for you to expand on that.
Yeah, I think that most people who are not familiar with these spaces and that world, which that world is, it's mostly a lot of sort of young white people sort of bouncing from context to context, and they work for these different organizations and they're the humanitarians or they're working in development or whatever, and they're there to, sort of save the world. I think that most people would be really, really shocked
just to see the sort of day by day, like, I mean, it's really, maybe it sounds excessively rhetorical, but I promise you it's not. It's really like a psycho-intellectual climate of apartheid around these people. You know, an amazing sort of tendency to inhabit gilded white ghettos, you know, luxury hotels, smoking imported cigarettes, drinking imported wine, spending $30-$40 on a meal, interacting practically not at all with any people, you know, sort of in the country for a myriad of reasons, you know, sort of sunbathing and enjoying their lives. And it really is, you know, I mean, if I were to picture, you know, read descriptions of, you know, how settlers sort of behaved in, you know, in Algeria, you know, under French sort of colonial control, it's not especially sort of different. Now, is this because people are, you know, in the aid sector are sitting around and sort of deciding like we're going to behave like settlers? Of course not. You know, when there are instances of this, of like these sorts of parallels, my attitude is generally it's because there's something structural going on. And indeed, like if you look at zooming out, if you look at the sort of behavior of these institutions, at the end of the day, they run on the same sort of tracks as, you know, predecessors that were sort of rigidly colonial and there to, you know, sort of engage in really sort of destructive behavior. So what am I talking about? So, you know, I sort of zooming out, not looking at, you know, the national park anymore. You know, another of the sort of issues that I've worked on a lot, you know, I worked with a team that broke the story of sexual exploitation and abuse in the Ebola response in Eastern DRC. So, you know, there was an Ebola outbreak, second biggest in the world behind West Africa. The response was led by WHO, carried out by tons of different, you know, NGOs and so forth. And we documented how, you know, overwhelmingly foreign staffers for WHO and other NGOs really set up rackets to sexually exploit and abuse, you know, sometimes rape local women in really remarkably heinous ways. You know, they're based in the same sort of luxury hotels where senior officials from the response are coming in and out, and they're carrying out the abuse in these hotels in front of everybody's eyes. They're sending drivers in marked WHO vehicles to pick up women, sometimes underage women, bring them back to these hotels where they're sexually exploited or abused. Really, really remarkable, brazen abuse. You know, we talked to 75 women who described this sort of abuse. WHO paid for a commission. They spoke to another 75 women. You know, in total, you have like 150 people sort of going on the record describing these sorts of abuse. And even that was, you know, really the tip of the iceberg. And really at the heart of it, the beating heart of a lot of that was power dynamics. You know, at the end of the day, the foreigners sort of coming in with these organizations instantly became some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in a very marginalized and, you know, war-torn, you know, sort of area in Eastern DRC. But it's not just sort of sexual exploitation and abuse. You know, you also had Ebola responders turning up in sort of militarized convoys alongside soldiers who've been, you know, responsible for heinous abuses against the population. You had remarkable examples of organized corruption, you know, theft on a massive scale. And all this culminated in real robust popular opposition, popular resistance to the Ebola response that the international media treated as like, oh, you know, I mean, the Congolese people are really confused about Ebola. You know, they just don't get it and they just don't understand how benevolent we are. I mean, really, like, look at the coverage. For 2 years, this response went on. It's all about, yeah, you know, Ebola fake news and WhatsApp groups, so forth. Our story about sexual exploitation and abuse published at the end of the response. You know, prior to that, there really was practically not a murmur about any of that in the international press. And part of the reason for that, and this is what's really crucial, is that the international journalists, and there are so many of them who were sort of parachuted in, were staying at the same sort of hotels, you know, with these same sort of white, you know, very much integrating themselves into this like psycho-intellectual climate of apartheid, you know, hanging out with the same people, talking to the same people, so forth. And what's probably most remarkable is the fact that these are supposed to be the better of our angels. You know, if we were getting an elevator pitch for like the global system as it exists. And, you know, we're doing an elevator pitch for aliens and we're telling the aliens, look, like there's Exxon Mobil and all these companies that like really engage in exploitation. But don't worry, because we also have, you know, these sorts of outfits that are lovely and come in and help people so tremendously. And the better of our angels are behaving in this sort of way. You know, it's really, you know, sort of remarkably disheartening. And it just reminds me of a quote from Saul Alinsky, who said, you know, I would rather rob a bank than be a recipient of charity. Because at the end of the day, at base, what's at question is power relations. You know, if I'm robbing the bank, I'm still in power. If I'm receiving charity, you know, I'm powerless in that sort of situation. And the governments that are funding these sorts of programs are the very same governments, you know, the US government, you know, the British government, so forth, that carved out these contexts in the first instance, carved out the conditions for grinding poverty in these contexts in the first place, backed IMF and World Bank programs that literally bludgeoned public sectors into oblivion, you know, which means there aren't, you know, sort of public goods provided in these contexts. And then they come in and say, we're here to save the day, like Pompier pyromonocracy, you know, Pompier is the French word for a firefighter, like, you know, burn down your house and then I'm here to help you put out the fire. And that's why, I mean, there are a lot of quotes from the sort of abolitionist literature about, you know, policing in the U.S. that I find to be really applicable sort of to the AIDS sector. Yeah, Derica Purnell wrote in her recent book about abolitionism that, you know, the abolitionist project is not just about like defunding police, shutting down police departments. It's also about building up the more egalitarian alternatives that sort of make these sorts of policing unnecessary. And indeed, if you don't sort of defund and shut down the police departments, then you're foreclosing on all of those alternatives. Likewise, with the sort of, you know, NGOs and, you know, sort of humanitarian organizations and so forth, what we're foreclosing on is a more egalitarian sort of alternative within which power really meaningfully exists in the hands of the people who are the supposed, you know, beneficiaries of all of this, as opposed to just being controlled by sort of, you know, bureaucracies who respond to the interests singularly of donor governments, which are the same governments that created a lot of the problems in the first interest. Yeah. Or in the first instance. Yeah.
So much of what you're saying actually reminds me of somebody who I've actually had on this program before to talk about South Sudan, who I know you're familiar with, Joshua Kraes, who has just like gone in on everything you've just talked about in the context of South Sudan, where he spent a lot of time researching and investigating and writing. I encourage people who want to hear more of like an expanded version of what you just mentioned to go check that interview out. Because, and also to read Joshua Kraes's work, because like, it really is incredible. It's like all over the place. And it's not just Africa. It's also the Middle East. It's also Latin America, but it's probably most extreme in Africa for many reasons. But if we could perhaps expand a little bit, you know, speaking of the Congo specifically, why does the Congo have so many militias? Why are there militias at all? And can you, you know, basically, can you speak also to the Western or imperialist role in causing the existence of those militias? Because the Congo wasn't always like this.
Yeah. Okay, well, buckle in. This one's a long one.
Yeah. I'm ready. Do you want to take a sip of water now? Do you need to take a sip of water before you, know you go
yeah,
into it?
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Right. No, I mean, look, at the end of the day, you know, when we're looking at the situation in Eastern DRC, here's a country, you know, it's among, in terms of like human development index and so forth, you know, it's some of the most remarkable, you know, poverty anywhere on the planet. You know, you alluded to, you know, the sort of armed conflict been going on since the mid 90s, based off of estimates that cut off at like 2006. We're looking at more than 5 million people died, who have died as a consequence of these conflicts, which makes it, you know, one of the most costly conflicts to human life of all of the conflicts on the planet anywhere since the Second World War. And yeah, I mean, generally, it's a sort of really remarkable situation that's rooted in sort of the long history. So, you know, we're actually coming up on June 30th, you know, which is the sort of day where, you know, commemorate Congolese independence from Belgian colonialism. And that's really sort of the place, I think, where we got to start to sort of meaningfully understand the situation. You know, the Congo was a Belgian colony. When it was a Belgian colony, you know, at first it was run by the personal fiefdom of this Belgian royal, King Leopold II, who, so as to extract rubber that provided the material basis for the Fordist automobile manufacturing boom, you know, for the tires for that, literally facilitated the murder of millions and millions of Congolese people, you know, somewhere between 6 and 10 million people. You know, then the Belgian state more formally assumed control. You know, that's the period, it's called the Belgian Congo, still have forced labor, you know, rigid racial hierarchy, so forth. That brings us up to 1960. And in 1960, Congo wins independence from Belgian colonial rule. The independence leader is a guy called Patrice Lumumba. And Lumumba is basically allowed 9 months to rule the country before he's, you know, brutally assassinated in a plot that implicated not just the Belgians, but also the U.S. government, also the United Nations. And this is really important. You know, for people who are interested in reading more, read Luda DeWitt's History of the Assassination of Lumumba. Read The Congo Cables, which is just based off of declassified documents by Madeleine Kalb. You know, there's a lot of really excellent sort of histories of this. But basically what happened was the Western governments backed a secessionist movement in two of the most mineral wealthy provinces in the country. One of these provinces was called Katanga. The people were sort of gendarmerie that was flown in to sort of lead the secessionist movement was entirely sort of white settler colonial. The leaders were entirely white settler colonialists. So people from South Africa, from Rhodesia, but also former Italian fascists and former members of the Waffen-SS flown in to lead the secessionist movement that before the end of 1960, so in a space of just like a couple months, massacres 60,000 members, you know, kills 60,000 members of one ethnic group, the Baluba, who are resisting, you know, the sort of secession as, you know, just a really straightforward example of sort of Belgian aggression in the country. While that's happening, the U.S. is providing covert support to this secessionist movement, you know, sort of flying in, bringing in French fighter jets and so forth, but also working behind the scenes with the UN at the time under Dag Hammarskjöld. And there's a really common sort of misperception that the UN came in on the right side of this and, you know, sort of beat back the Belgian colonialists. Look at the period before Lumumba was assassinated. Before Lumumba was assassinated, Hammarskjöld opined that Lumumba must be broken. The head of the UN, Andrew Cordier, worked closely with the Eisenhower administration as the Eisenhower administration's literally plotting to assassinate Lumumba. Cordier opined that Lumumba was Africa's little Hitler. You know, of course, the fact that the U.S. was actively supporting a secessionist outfit that killed 60,000 members of one ethnic group and was led by former members of the Waffen-SS didn't really frustrate such polite, you know, moral formulation. But nonetheless, this was the position of the head of the U.N. mission. U.N. worked to secretly provide money to this guy who came to be called Mobutu Sese Seko at the time, Joseph Désiré Mobutu, who ultimately would organize a successful coup in the capital, Leopoldville. The CIA provided government provided intelligence to Mobutu's troops, who shipped Lumumba off to Katanga province, where he was killed by a Belgian, chopped up and dissolved in acid. After that point, all of Lumumba's associates, and this is really important, these were parliamentary anti-colonialists, really not a radical cohort of people, were throttled into a position of sort of radical anti-colonial, you know, revolutionary resistance to what they correctly perceived to be a sort of Western-backed takeover of the newly independent country. In this time period, one of these guys, Antoine Gizenga, led a sort of revolutionary movement that the U.S. perceived as so dangerous that the Pentagon drew up plans for an 80,000-man land invasion of the country, you know, a sort of Congo-American war. And this is what's really fascinating. This is exactly the time period where you have a sort of faltering U.S.-backed dictator in South Vietnam. You know, another sort of former colonial context. And it was sort of like a game, like, let's see which sort of US-backed proxy in a former colony is the stronger of the two. And indeed, the sort of leadership in the Congo, backed by the US, proved to be stronger than Diem in South Vietnam.
Right.
And ultimately, the military commitments were made in Vietnam. Nonetheless, you have, you know, sort of a really radicalized opposition. Ultimately, by the middle of the 60s, this radicalized opposition has assumed control of half of the country. They called it the Simba Rebellion. They declared a People's Republic. And the U.S. helped organize an instant air force for the U.S.-backed regime in the capital. And piloted by, you know, this instant air force piloted by Cubans who flew in the Bay of Pigs invasion, delivered, again, sort of white settler colonialists.
You gotta, you know, love that inner, you gotta love that intersectionality, you know?
Yeah, there's like all the connections. Yeah,
fascists, you know,
everybody's
yeah.
favorites. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Flew in, again, people from Rhodesia, South Africa, who defeated the rebels and then massacred people in a town called Kindu, like thousands of people. And from that point, you basically have this Western-backed government led by this kleptomaniac, Mobutu. One of the reasons that Washington continued to back Mobutu was the fact that he supported U.S. efforts to resist the anti-colonialists in Angola. So in Angola, the U.S. collaborated with apartheid South Africa, fought against the anti-colonialists, first sort of worked alongside the Portuguese colonizer, later on, you know, worked with elements, you know, sort of aligned with apartheid South Africa. In the Reagan years alone, 1 million people were killed in Angola. You know, Mobutu, he changed the name of the country to Zaire. Mobutu Zaire was really sort of a launching pad for that sort of foreign policy. Then, we're moving through. Let me take another sip of water.
And these are the Cliff Notes version too, by the way.
Yeah, there's a lot I'm leaving out. A lot of heinous stuff I'm leaving out, actually.
No, it's actually so disgusting. Like, please continue.
Yeah. This is really like tip of the iceberg stuff. And again, it's not like none of it's like, you know, it's well, you know, it's respected, you know, the most respected sort of histories of the Congo, you know, touch on all of this. A lot of them misframe it, you know, because you got to like, you know, you got to sort of pepper things around here and there, and you can't sort of challenge the interests of, you know, powerful governments if you want to be a respected person in the academy. But it's all there, right. And, you know, every sort of major history about the Congo, it's just, you know, not really sort of thought about all that much. But nonetheless, then you have, at the end of the Cold War, you know, this really interesting sort of continental reshuffle where, you know, basically a bunch of stooges, both for, you know, the US and for the Soviets, lose their sort of, you know, political value, you know, lose their sort of value and lose their support pretty substantially. So like Siad Barre, who was backed by the US in Somalia, you know, his regime pretty much immediately collapses. You've got a similar dynamic with Juvenal Habyarimana in Rwanda, and the collapse of his regime immediately sort of precipitated the Rwandan genocide. And you have a similar dynamic with Mobutu. By the mid-90s, you know, is really sort of floundering, struggling for international support. And this is the period at which, you know, in the mid-90s, you have an invasion of the country, you know, so-called alliance invasion, really spearheaded by the country's two most significant probably neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda. And this invasion received substantial U.S. support in a lot of different ways. For those who are interested in this, you know, you can read Gerard Prunier's account of the war. There was support from the U.S. Embassy, really substantial support from the U.S. Embassy in Kigali, even remarkable indifference to reports of massive massacres of civilians, examples of things happening like Rwandan troops being sent in to with cobbler's hammers to smash people's skulls mostly of, you know, sort of elderly people and children and women, people who couldn't flee. The reason for the Rwandan invasion was the fact that the perpetrators of the Rwandan genocide had organized a strategic retreat into Congo. But at the end of the day, the people who were targeted by this campaign of violence were overwhelmingly not the perpetrators of the Rwandan genocide, or, you know, sort of an even mix. But nonetheless, these invaders sort of swept clear across the country, installed sort of an old guard rebel in power in the capital, old guard Congolese rebel in power in the capital. And then when that old guard Congolese rebel said that, okay, you know, thanks for your help, but, you know, we don't want the country to be permanently occupied by Rwanda and Uganda, so you have to leave, that immediately ignited, a reignition of the conflict and what's called the Second Congo War. And this is really probably the most remarkable period. So if you look at, as an example, UN Group of Experts report from 2002, the indication is that as a direct consequence of this occupation, which again, you know, this is at least at a, you know, political diplomatic level, receives cover and support from, you know, from the US and so forth, as a direct consequence of this occupation, somewhere between 2 and 3 million people were killed. There's a really interesting study written by these two anthropologists, Smith and Mance, around that time as well, called Du Cellophone's Dream of Civil War, which talks about the extraction of columbite tantalite and the way in which that helped feed the sort of revolution in microcomputing in the global north. And among other things, there are descriptions of instances where the sort of Rwandan government-backed militias that, you know, are literally forcing people at gunpoint to pull coltan out of the ground are directly negotiating with executives at Citibank, partially because there was so much demand for the 2000 release of the Sony PlayStation 2. There was so much demand for this mineral coltan, you know, that they're like, you know, we need more coltan. We got to get more out of the ground. So here's like another really direct example of a relationship between development in the global north or technological advances in the global north and widespread misery and death in the Congo. Of course, you know, this sort of dependency on coltan did not continue to be a primary driver of the conflict. But nonetheless, you know, that sort of history is there. So these are a lot of the sort of longer sort of drivers. But one thing, you know, that I like to point out is that all of this is really not conceptual, and it's not just sort of like academic and historical. At the end of the day, looking at, you know, the Congo as such, here's a country where it functionally was allowed 9 months to sort of rule itself, you know, really. You know, you had one sort of democratically elected leader with a real robust sort of mandate assassinated through collaboration between the UN, the US, Belgium, so forth. Then the country is run into the ground for 3 decades by a Western-backed kleptomaniac. Then the country is invaded. You know, there's a Western-backed invasion. Millions of people are killed. You know, guys installed in power in Kinshasa. He's ultimately assassinated. His son assumes control. And that brings us up to 2018, you know. So really, there's not any period between like 1961 and 2018 within which it can be all that meaningfully said that this is a country that has achieved full and proper, you know, sort of independence from external violence and from the external imposition of other countries' will. Yeah.
And that's, of course, like, not to mention, you know, where the starting off point was already, you know, was already messed up because of the colonialism that preceded that. I mean, it's just incredible because then you just have this attitude of like, why is it so, why are people there so violent? Like, why is there so much violence? These places are just like backward. We don't understand why. But you know, for years, the UN has had this mission in the Congo that is even allowed to engage in combat, largely as, you know, justified because of the violence there. Has this mission helped or has it harmed stability in the Congo?
I just made reference to the fact that the, you know, the first sort of proper UN intervention in the Congo was playing a decisive role in the assassination of, you know, of the independence leader. You know, I mean, that's really not insignificant. And, you know, just already on its face already, if you're making an argument to me like, yeah, I literally helped to carve out, you know, the sort of Congo-shaped charnel house in Central Africa,
but, you know, now we're here to help. I'm already skeptical. You know, already I'm not buying whatever it is you're selling. So I don't really think that that's insignificant. But looking at the UN's approach, I mean, there's a lot here. I'll try to be succinct, but there's really a lot of remarkable stuff here. One person who's written, I think, really intelligently about this issue is an academic called Marta de Heredia. And she spent time with members of Mai-Mai militias in Tanganyika province and tried to sort of understand popular support that is voluntarily provided by members of a lot of communities to members of these sort of Mai-Mai groups. And she makes the point that the UN, aware of the fact, basically, that there are a lot of communities throughout Eastern DRC that, push comes to shove, would voluntarily prefer to support militias over the Congolese army, and nevertheless, providing substantial support to the Congolese army, you know, is pretty remarkable and inexplicable, and in point of fact, destabilizing. Well, what am I getting at? If you look at UN figures, let's look at UN figures about the Congolese army and abuses that are conducted in Eastern DRC. The UN estimates, it varies year to year, but basically every single year, on average, the Congolese army is responsible for about 50% of the abuses conducted in Eastern DRC, abuses of human rights. And the other 50% are carried out by the, you know, 120 plus different armed groups put together. Now, if we could imagine a scenario within which, you know, the UN is coming in and saying, you know, we're here to keep the peace, we're, you know, peacekeepers, whatever, and they go into a context and they, you know, work against 119 different armed groups, and then there's one really significant armed group that they just ignore, you know, maybe coincidentally, whatever. That would be, you know, sort of scandalous in its own right. But even more scandalous if that group were so significant that it's, you know, the biggest armed group and responsible for 50% of the abuses. That'd be pretty enormous. It'd be even more of a scandal if the UN were providing support to this armed group secretly, and even more of a scandal yet if the UN were actually openly promoting an approach to peacemaking, which is let's support this armed group and help this armed group to put down all of the other armed groups around that country. Now we can stop imagining, because that's exactly what the UN does. It works in lockstep with the Congolese army, which is rightfully regarded by a lot of people in Eastern DRC as repressive and destructive. I have a friend who likes to share an anecdote. I can't say who they are, but likes to share an anecdote about an employee of the UN, a Congolese person, who sent out to like sensitize populations to the mission of the UN, and went out on one particular occasion and said, like, look, our mandate is this and this and this and that. We're here to, you know, help the army, ba 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 ba. And one woman said to this person, well, if you're here to help the army, you're here to help the people who are raping us and plundering our villages. So we're not on the same side. Thing is, if you look at the UN's approach, at least since 2009, 2010, there's a very interesting article written by my colleague Rachel Sweet about this, called Militarizing the Peace. Since 2009, 2010, the UN has publicly, in its sort of peacekeeping outfit, publicly taken a sort of counterinsurgency approach. Literally sort of ripped pages straight from General Petraeus's handbook in Afghanistan, and put them to the test in Eastern DRC. Not only that, you alluded to, you know, in some, there are some outfits that have an offensive mandate. Part of that has been in connection with ostensible terrorists in one area in Beni, which, you know, we'll talk about that, I think, in a bit. The UN has actually carried out bombing runs, you know, bombing runs where, you know, UN helicopters are going and bombing jungle canopy. And I've had conversations with senior people in the UN who've, you know, literally said, like, we haven't known what we're hitting. Now, this is not happening. The bombing runs aren't so much happening today. They went on, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, really in force, really aggressively, but saying,
we don't know what we're hitting. Also referring to civilians potentially killed in those bombing runs as collateral damage. You know, it's really sort of remarkable, like Bush administration rhetoric about, you know, the possibility that civilians are being killed. But at base, what you have is the sort of approach to, you know, war making, which is rigidly sort of colonial in character, you know, looking at what happened in Afghanistan, you know, what really one of the great gifts to the world from the U.S. misadventure in Afghanistan was the reinvigoration of this sort of esoteric doctrine for war making rooted in, like, you know, putting down colonial emergencies and so forth that we call counterinsurgency. But one of the core premises is the idea that there is no legitimate relationship between populations and armed groups. Like, there's just no way in which people would voluntarily support armed groups. So all you got to do is sort of separate the, you know, fish from the pond, create islands of stability, blah, 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 blah. And that washes up on the reality in Eastern DRC where, yeah, as the Heredia documents, push comes to shove, a lot of people would sort of, you know, prefer to support an armed group over the Congolese army. And the other thing that I think is interesting is at the end of the day, you know, another thing out of Afghanistan, you know, that we find is sort of like war making as state building. You know, like, I remember a lot of comments around the time of the withdrawal. Like, if you've been there for 2 decades, and then as soon as you withdraw, everything collapses, you haven't really been building a state. You've been running an occupation, you know, sort of functions like an occupation. Indeed, in Eastern DRC, there are a lot of people who really see the peacekeeping outfit as functioning basically like a sort of militarized occupation. And would be content, you know, for it to sort of leave. And this, you know, sorry if it's a little bit long-winded, and you can cut it out if it is. But I think that there's a very interesting analogy to Northern Ireland, actually. I remember a conversation that Bernadette Devlin, who was, you know, an Irish Republican, she slapped an official in the UK government in the face after he argued that the Bloody Sunday massacre was in self-defense. And she went on William F. Buckley's program and was asked, like, something along the lines of, okay, so you have this and that to say about the British Army, you know, you have all these nasty things to say, but what would happen tomorrow if the British Army withdrew? You know, because I think what would happen, you know, this is the sort of right-wingers asking her this, I think what would happen is more of the sort of Irish Catholics that you love so much would be massacred. So what do you have to say to that? And what she said was, well, the first thing that would happen, actually, is that people would go out in the streets and cheer and applaud, and that should tell you a lot. That should tell you a lot about how people feel about this. But at the end of the day, if you look at what the British Army, you know, did in Northern Ireland, it went in, claimed to sort of be neutral, claimed to fill a peacekeeping function, but at the end of the day was very much a partisan in the conflict. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, provided covert support to right-wing paramilitaries, as well as open support to, you know, sort of destructive outfits that were, you know, massacring people. And we'll talk about a bit about this in connection with the sort of, you know, ISIS terrorism stuff. But, you know, the parallels are pretty remarkable. And indeed, you know, I mean, I was there in really dramatic demonstrations at the end of 2019 when Congolese people stormed a UN battalion in a town called Beni, you know, sort of burnt it down, you know, sort of ripped out, you know, a lot of the things in the offices, and were chanting Leo and Joe Leo, which means today means today, like, get the hell out, you know. And there again, like, a lot of the international media stuff talking about that incident sort of said, like, the Congolese people are begging the UN to protect them better. No,
they're asking
is pretty straightforward. So, wow. You know, I think that there are a lot of sort of interesting parallels there between sort of historic, you know, sort of occupations, colonial occupations, and Quelle Surprise. When we're talking about the UN, let us not forget the beginning of the UN intervention in the country was working with the former colonizer to help assassinate the independence leader. So again, it's not all that conceptual. There is a direct sort of link there, yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. And then, of course, as you kind of mentioned a little bit about, you know, there have been claims that ISIS is operating in the Congo, but you have disputed that. You've even written basically against that. So can you tell us what's really going on?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, it's very complicated, and I will, there's some that I can't say because of sort of ongoing investigations that we're working on. But I think probably the most important dynamic here, you know, I mean, if we look at the sort of international, you know, war on terror and the trappings of it sort of all over the world, one thing that's really pronounced that seems to crop up in a lot of different contexts is the sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, as an example, like, you know, in the US is making its argument to go into Iraq, you know, you've got talk about Al-Qaeda in Iraq, you know, Al-Qaeda training camps, whatever, that stuff that was extracted from torture proved to be not true. But also talk about this guy Zarqawi, who, like, you know, he's in northern Iraq because Zarqawi's there. That means Saddam Hussein is working with Al-Qaeda, blah, 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 blah. Well, Zarqawi did go into Iraq, but he went into Iraq, you know, anticipating the U.S. invasion. So, you know, here you have this sort of like, you create the enemy that you want to fight. And I think you have a very interesting similar dynamic in Eastern DRC. So if we're looking at sort of the Islamic State and, you know, the idea that the Islamic State is active in any meaningful capacity in Eastern DRC, I'm pausing to take a sip of water. Hopefully, that might actually be really terrible for you to edit. I'm sorry. It's like a jump cut.
No, it's okay. I'm going to leave the sip of water in. I think it's become kind of like an endearing part of the interview.
Nice. Even better. Even better.
Okay. Take all the sips you need.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, you're killing me here, Rania Halep. You're killing me, you know? Like, you're clearly in league with the conservationists.
You know, 100%. Trying to hunt you down. I'm trying to, like, stuff you full of so much water that right, you're just, like, right. Too bloated. You're too bloated to do your work.
Okay, so looking at the talk about the Islamic State in Eastern DRC, you know, what's at question is this one armed group called the Allied Democratic Forces. It's a group that originally comes from Uganda and is active around that town that I mentioned with the sort of anti-UN protests, Beni. And looking at the sort of long history of the, you know, talk about there being ISIS in Eastern DRC. It all began before even ISIS claimed that ISIS had any relationship to this outfit, before any, there were any sort of public claims to this effect. There was a remarkable sort of group of people publishing what I would say is really sort of bad faith stuff, and I can only say so much about this, but publishing people with connections to the US government, publishing mm-hmm. bad faith materials, insinuating that there is this link. And that claim was picked up, among other people, by the New York, among other outfits, by the New York Times, you know, New York Times, which also contributed pretty substantially to lying the American public into the war in Iraq. And in connection with the New York Times saying, look, ISIS has a toehold in DRC. Actually, the journalist who wrote that was Rukmini Kalimaki, who, you know, is famous for
disgraced, you know, journalist.
Yeah, disgraced. Ah, thank you. Yes, disgraced journalist Rukmini Kalimaki. It's famous for, you know, basically running wild with, you know, sort of accounts of jihadists doing this and that and whatever else. Based off of uncorroborated information and so forth. In connection with this, the Congolese president made a visit to Washington around the time that that article was published and spoke to John Bolton, spoke to Mike Pompeo, spoke to the CIA director at the time, gave a rousing speech at the Atlantic Council saying, Daesh is setting up its caliphate in Congo. You know, we need all this support. That was the beginning of the establishment of a sort of track to proper bilateral military cooperation between the U.S. and DRC in connection with this sort of issue. After all of this noise, after the New York Times, Atlantic Council, everyone saying, you know, that you've got ISIS in DRC, then, you know, the Islamic State sort of woke up and said, well, hey, I guess we're in DRC. And so you have through their propaganda arm.
I'm sorry, I did not mean to laugh like that. You made me laugh. It's not a funny situation. The idea of ISIS just like talking like that, like, well, hey, I guess we got to go to DRC now.
Wow, cool. You've got their propaganda, one of their propaganda arms, AMAC, beginning to make claims of a relationship between the Islamic State and ADF, beginning to claim attacks that ADF conducted. Looking at the beginning of these claims, it's very interesting. One thing that's sort of a bizarre fact about me, I was actually raised in Las Vegas, Nevada, of all places, you know, sort of ass crack of the universe. And there was in October 2017, many people remember there was a famous horrific mass shooting carried out by, you know, this lunatic who blew out a window in a big hotel and shot at concert goers. The Islamic State actually claimed that attack, you know, said that the shooter... Yeah, said that the shooter was a, you know, soldier of the caliphate, so forth. The Islamic State also claimed a botched robbery around this time in the Philippines, claimed the placement of a bomb that just didn't happen in Charles de Gaulle Airport after seeing media reports. So you've got this sort of trend where initially Amak claims were very reliable. And then when the Islamic State started to get beaten back, in Syria in particular, you started to see these sort of wild claims, right? Okay, so Amak begins claiming attacks in Eastern DRC. At the beginning, you know, there's a really thorough analysis of this in a group of experts report, I think in 2020 or 2021, where they break down these Amak claims and say basically a third of them just don't even correspond to any real incident that actually happened. A third of them loosely correspond to a real incident, but you know, the date, the village, the numbers of casualties, like it's really dramatically off. And then there's another third that are actually like more or less accurate. So that was the beginning of that trend. Around this time period, I was in Beni and I conducted interviews with all of the detained ADF combatants who were available in multiple detention facilities. So multiple combatants of this group who, you know, this group, which is supposedly, you know, the in league with ISIS. I could not talk to a single combatant in this time period who had even heard of ISIS, let alone of any sort of like international support, anything, you know, nothing at all. Now we're in 2020. Okay. Moving forward, interestingly, in the last sort of 2 years, you have indeed sort of begun to see the slow sort of process of more concrete things emerging that are indicating at least the groups are talking to each other. There's perhaps some sort of technical assistance. And it, of course, you know, the sort of crusaders who are saying that ISIS is in ADF or ISIS is in Congo before literally anyone else are using that as sort of a victory lap. Like, look at this and that tangible piece of evidence, when in point of fact, it really appears a lot more like the classic sort of war on terror, self-fulfilling prophecy dynamic that I think is really important. Additionally, and this is really crucial, in the area, you know, Beni, where, you know, you have a lot of the violence going on, you know, that's attributed to ADF, it's Islamic terror, so forth, there's a really substantial, long history of violence actually being carried out by the Congolese army itself, carried out by the Congolese army and then labeled as, you know, ADF, terrorism, whatever. And there's a really remarkable sort of example of this that connects with everything we were just talking about with the UN, that I was sort of alluding to, where a Congolese general called General Mundos, who led joint UN-Congolese army operations to fight against the ADF, it was revealed by the UN group of experts, was actually secretly not only providing support to ADF, but also organizing his own separate death squads that were, you know, sort of killing people in attacks that were, you know, treated like terrorist violence. And when he was confronted by this, he said to the group of experts, no, you know, it's not me. It's, you know, jihadism, terrorism, blah, 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 blah. You know, again, the sort of blanket reference to terrorism. Incidentally, it's just sort of an interesting anecdote. This guy was in charge in the Congo. He was moved after the scandal associated with this. And he went to the area where Kahuzi Biega National Park is and was the general who was in charge through a lot of the sort of campaign of violence, which was carried out against the Batwa, which is supported by the army. And he gave an interview to a German journalist, Simone Schlinwein, who writes for Taz. And he said, yeah, the Batwa are terrorists. So it's sort of like amazing, like the, you know, the way these things sort of like, you know, run on loop. But anyway, that's just to say all of the international actors want to go in and fight terrorists in DRC, you know, which include the U.S. government. And that's, right. you know, really sort of intensifying U.S. government programs looking at terrorism in Eastern DRC. And when I started looking at this in 2019, a lot of people said, Robert, you're crazy. There's not going to be any sort of formal U.S. government, anything at all. Now, this is really the direction that it's moving. But anyway, all of the internationals.
You've been vindicated.
Sweet vindication. All the international actors that want to go in and, you know, fight terrorists in Eastern DRC, their partner of choice is the Congolese army. And, you know, that poses a really substantial problem if the Congolese army is itself implicated historically and right. likely at the present in really serious violence against civilians. And so what I see generally is a lot of the trappings of, you know, what we see all over the world in the context of the so-called U.S. war on terror, U.S.-led war on terror, you know, the self-fulfilling prophecy dynamic, you know, blind support for repressive state security forces, even the like UN bombing runs, you know, we don't know what we're hitting in the jungle, collateral damage, things like this. Frame, you know, depoliticizing conflicts, treating an armed group like a just sort of like fundamentally evil franchise that can only be reduced to, you know, a sort of franchise for international, you know, sort of actors. All of this is very much at play in the context in Eastern DRC. And I think that if anybody has any questions as to how that will likely play out, you know, just look at every other context all over the world where it's happened. And you can see the sort of charnel houses and the, you know, pummeled and the annihilated villages and countries, and, you know, get a good sense of where this leads us in Eastern DRC if things continue in this direction. Yeah.
I feel like this is a good place to maybe conclude, because I mean, this has been such an incredible interview. I want to link to all the resources people can look to read your report, to read some of the coverage of the report. And what's happened in the aftermath. I know there was recently like an Al Jazeera investigation that's quite lengthy that came out based on this. So I'll link to that in the description. But beyond that, where can people go to follow your work, to find out more about everything you've discussed? I mean, you mentioned some books throughout, obviously, so those are good resources. Yeah. But yeah, basically, this is the shout out section. Give all your shout outs here. Where should people go? Where should people go to find you and your work?
If people want to do to themselves the unique disservice of reading anything I have to write, then probably the best place for them to go. I'm very bad at this sort of like social media self-promotion stuff. So the only place that they can go really is my Twitter, which is my handle is Radical Muzungu. And Muzungu is the sort of term for like, you know, white guy, basically. So Radical Muzungu, at Radical Muzungu is the place where people should go if they want to subject themselves to the torture, not US-backed torture, but torture of reading my work. Yeah.
So this is like the sort of like self-deprecation. Is this like a Las Vegas thing?
Here we go. Now everything I say, doesn't matter how intelligent the political analysis is,
everyone's
whatever.
Everyone's going to be like, that
guy's going to be like, the Las Vegas
produced
thing.
By yeah. Las Vegas.
Next time I'm gonna wear a Hawaiian shirt, you know.
You gotta embrace it.
That's right. Fear and loathing. Fear and
embrace
loathing.
Your heritage. Yeah. On that note, Robert, thank you so much for the incredible work you've done. Please stay safe, because clearly, like, what you've done has angered a lot of very powerful people. And I hope that we get a chance to have you on the future, because there's like so many more things I wanted to ask you about and could ask you about. And you're so knowledgeable about all this stuff. So really, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rania. You're awesome. I really appreciate it. Thank you.